The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So the body is a very important part of our practice. It's really our vehicle for enlightenment. And this is where it's the locus for enlightenment. This is where it happens. So it's a place to really bring a lot of attention what's happening in the body. And in our basic meditation posture, then we have these two energetic patterns of the body that we're sort of cultivating. So in the lower body, just like in the standing posture, the lower body is the sort of our foundation. It's our ground. So the lower body is really what connects with the earth and gives us a place where we can settle. And it doesn't really matter if we're sitting on a chair or if we're sitting on the floor. It's the same energetic pattern. And as we saw, we can also employ it when we're standing. So you can meditate in all sorts of postures and you can find where these two energetic patterns are. So the grounding, the rooting, and then the other, the energetic pattern, which is more associated with the upper body, is this sort of dignified, wakeful quality in the upper body. And this goes with these two qualities of meditation, of being deeply relaxed and being clear and wakeful. What the Buddha described as, we compare this to the guitar strings. So if the string is too tight, then it breaks. And if the string is too loose, then there's no sound. So we want a string that's evenly balanced with this quality of relaxation, but also clarity, wakefulness. And the two go together, they in the body and in the mind, which is why we put the body into a particular position when we come to meditate, when we come to practice, because it affects the mind. And this is something there's, nowadays we have all this wonderful scientific research, which is, in many instances, it's really validating, not that we probably need this, but it's interesting that it does this. It validates a lot of Buddhist practice. There was a TED talk recently by a social psychologist called Amy Cuddy, and it's all about how what we do with the body influences our personality. She was calling it personality, but it's how we feel. So what she was particularly talking about in this instance was, she calls them power poses. So like a power pose would be like this, or this. Standing or sitting, they tried them both ways. And then the opposite of a power pose would be something like this, or this. Like when we're touching ourselves a lot, apparently this is kind of enveloping ourselves. That's the opposite of a power pose. And what they found was, just by putting someone in one of these poses, these kind of upright, open-hearted poses, was that they, even just 2 minutes, their testosterone level would increase, so their sense of power, strength would increase, and cortisol, the stress hormone, would decrease. So that's really interesting because it connects with the kind of poses we use in meditation, right? So even just sometimes we can feel, you know, it's very difficult to work with the mind, or maybe we don't feel that we can get to the meditation cushion, but if we know this is one of the wonderful things about this research, if we know that actually all I have to do is put my body in this position. Now, if I can get that far, I'm in meditation. Something will be happening, an effect will be happening. Which is wonderful, right? Okay, I just need to get this far and then I'll take it from there. Because very often we then find, oh, once I've got the body there, actually, I can do it. Right, but it's getting it there in the first place. So this is a little kind of gem that we can hold on to of just get the body into the meditation posture. And there's a Tibetan master, 16th century Tibetan master called Dagpo Tashi Namgyel, who was a great Mahamudra meditation master, a particular style of meditation. And this is what he says is, you could just begin your meditation practice is just to sit in the posture and feel the body. And that's it. No further instruction than that. Because they knew from experience, not with machines, but from experience, they know how important the body is in meditation. So we have at Wisdom Sun, this is my husband, Ori Goldfield, who wanted to come here and be with us all today as well. And this is everything that we do, we call it's Dharma Lab, L-A-B. So the lab is love, awareness, body. And then the lab is also this quality of exploration, of curiosity, of trying things on and seeing, well, what does happen? And that's really how Buddhism has been practiced all these hundreds of years. And this is how they've come to these things that now science is saying, oh yes, that is valid, by trying it and seeing, oh yeah, this is the effect this has. And this is really what the Buddha was encouraging us to do when he talked about these teachings being, we should take them on as if we were gold merchants. Right, so we're in the marketplace to buy some gold, and someone says, yes, I have some great gold, here you go. You don't just go, okay, great, how much would you like for that, and take it home, right? You might want to be a little bit more curious, like, okay, maybe I can test this gold and see, is it what you say it is? And really, with the Buddha's teachings, that's the only way that you get the gold. If you just say, yeah, it's gold, and you take it home and you put it on your shelf, so what, right? It's not going to have an effect. So it's really, we're always being encouraged, it's about engagement, engagement, engagement. And it's also, you know, what the Buddha gave us so many skillful methods, so many meditation techniques, so many great teachings. So it's also a question of not just, you know, is it empirically gold or not gold, but what is the gold for me at this point in my life today? You know, what am I needing? Where's my practice today? So I think that's, I just wanted to talk about a few of these kind of essential pith elements of Buddhism this morning, and I think this is one, is to be curious and to be engaged and have a sense of experimentation. And then these qualities, love, awareness, and body. So we've kind of covered body a little bit, so I'd also like to bring in love and awareness. So love is this quality, it's the compassion that's talked about in Buddhism. Loving kindness, compassion. And then awareness is this quality of knowing, of wisdom. And traditionally these are talked about as being the two wings of a bird, our bird of practice. So we don't want a one-winged bird, it's not going to fly, right? You know, we could be the most intelligent person when it comes to the Dharma and have, you know, memorized all these texts and be able to talk about it. But if we're not really integrating our wisdom in a way that it affects how we feel and affects our relationships and increases our compassion, that's a one-winged bird, right? And the same if we just have compassion. Actually, it's very difficult to have compassion without understanding what's going on. And we get into a lot of trouble. Probably, maybe some people have this experience. I certainly have had this experience when I've tried to help someone, but I don't know enough, you know? And my idea of kind of being compassionate or helpful is not very skillful. it's being hampered by my level of understanding, by my awareness, by my wisdom. So we really need both of these qualities. We need the love and we need the awareness. We need the compassion and we need the wisdom. And these love and awareness are found in the body, and they're experienced in the body. So all of these three are kind of like different elements, but they're really kind of in unity. All three come together. So in terms of having a sort of pith understanding of love or compassion, I have this line from Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who's a great Tibetan master. And he says, this is what compassion says. It says, be what you are. There is your ground to be. I am at your service. So compassion, you know, sometimes compassionate activity, we think, you know, what's beneficial? I'd like to do this, I'd like to do that. But really sort of the fundamental aspect of compassion is, can we allow people, can we allow ourselves to be who we are? And are we willing to engage with people as they are and to see them as they are? Can we see each other just directly, without manipulating that? And this really requires us to be able to see ourselves as we are and to be ourselves. Because our external relationships are just a reflection of our internal relationship. So how we talk to ourselves, if we berate ourselves all the time, if we judge ourselves all the time, oh, you did that really badly. Why did you have to say it like that? You know, you should have done better. You're just not doing well enough. All these different things that we say to ourselves. If that's our internal relationship, that's really going to be how we are relating with others. It's not a good place to relate with others from. It's not helpful for us. We know that when we feel bad, it's so much harder to be kind to others. And when we feel good, it's just natural. Just naturally, we don't really need to think about it. It's kind of like we feel good and it just overflows. There's an abundance. And we just naturally do what we can to make others feel good. So we don't want to judge our own experience, how we are, or compare ourselves. I should be more like this other person. Why don't I have the life that they have? Or ignoring. My experience isn't of value. It's not worth paying attention to. So this is saying, we can just let that go. We can just say, okay, how am I at the moment? What's happening? Be curious about our experience. And can I, whatever experience I have, whatever's going on, however I'm reacting to things, can I just say, ah, okay, I can see that. I can be with that. And a lot of this is really connected with our ability to be in the present moment. Because this is where our experience is, right? It's right here. And a lot of the time we're sort of projecting forward. There's a strong push around what our future experience will be. Or we feel like, oh, when I have these things in place, then I can be happy, then I can relax. Now, once I've got this job or I've finished this work or, you know, these batch of things that I have to do, or I've got this relationship or in order, or when I go on holiday, we're always pushing it out into the future. But then I can take some time, then I can see what's going on, then I can relax, then I can be happy. And the future is never arrives, right? It's never here. So we're just putting off our life. And even like the present moment, we know it's so fluid, it's constantly moving. Like you can't even grasp the present moment. But we know that the present moment, it does offer this invaluable opportunity to be. It's a place where we can just drop into this deep profundity of our present experience. And it's extremely nourishing when we do that. It doesn't really depend on what the experience is. It's just being present and open to now. Because that's where our life is, right? This is life. Right here, right now. It's not when I have this in the future, all those ideas, all those concepts. So compassion says, be who you are. That's the starting place. That's your ground. And then it says, in Trungpa Rinpoche's quote, it says, I am at your service. So I am in the service of what is in this moment. What is for myself, what is for you. Because we know there's no fixed self, right? I'm always changing. Every moment my experience is different. And that's the same for every one of us. So I'm just in service to what is showing up in this moment. And this is actually very, very similar to the essence of wisdom or awareness. So there's tomes that have been written on wisdom and from the Buddhist perspective and the true nature of reality of myself, of others, and there are all of these different schools of thought within Buddhism that have slightly different perspectives. But really what wisdom is being able to see things as they are. So I have another quote from Trungpa Rinpoche. He says, the wisdom of dealing with situations as they are, and this is what wisdom is, contains tremendous precision that could not come from anywhere else, but the physical situations of sight, smell, feelings, touchable objects and sounds. The earthy situation of actual things as they are is the source of wisdom. You can become completely one with smell, with sight, with sound, and your knowledge about them ceases to exist. Your knowledge becomes wisdom. This is a really powerful statement that wisdom is the ability to be with things as they are. And it's actually, when you do that, there is no sense of me being with something other. This is where the non-duality of Buddhism comes in. When we can really be with things as they are, actually, we are completely one with that experience. So it's not knowledge, which still has this idea of here am I being knowledgeable about something else. And the idea of wisdom is actually when the subject and object duality is completely dissolved. That's the only way to really know something, when it's no longer separate. You know it so well, you're so intimately connected. And this is what's described as the true nature, it is non-dual. And how we get there is to just really be, and it's fearless, right? That does take a lot of courage, just to be in the present moment and be with things as they are. so intimately connected with the practice that we're doing here this morning, with our meditation practice, the ability to be still, the ability to open, to listen, that allows our wisdom to just naturally deepen. And that allows us to become one with our experience and to become one with each other, to become one with our world. So it's kind of, it might sound a little bit of a tall order, right? But on the other hand, we have the teachings from, they're called the Buddha Nature Teachings, the Buddha Nature Treatise, which is one of the five texts of the Buddha Maitreya. And in this text, he says, all sentient beings have the Buddha nature. Therefore, all sentient beings are worthy. So one of the reasons this text was taught was to give us confidence. Because sometimes it can sound like a lot, and it can sound like a lot of fearlessness and courageousness is being asked of us. And this teaching gives us confidence. So a sentient being is basically described in Buddhism as being something that moves towards pleasure and away from pain. That makes us sentient. And actually, just in that very act, it also means that we have the Buddha nature within us. Even if just in that moment, it's for ourselves. It's like we want to be free of suffering and we want to be happy. And these qualities, the basic components of Buddha nature, are these qualities of love and awareness, compassion and wisdom. And we all have them. They're just innate to being a sentient being. So they're there. They're right there. And then everything on the path is just, well, how fully can I manifest these qualities? Can I keep increasing these qualities so that they are present in the world? So, kind of a tall order, a lot has been asked of us, and at the same time we're being told it's possible. We can do it. So I would welcome any comments or questions that you have.
Thank you, Rose. That was really nice exercise. Do you have any suggestions for when we're around people who are being very negative? Maybe they're having an ain't it a shame session and they're complaining about
having
this.
A what session?
Oh, ain't it a shame? Where you complain about this and you complain about that. And how do we stay open and say in non-duality when we don't really want that kind of energy around us?
What's your feeling when you're with someone who's doing that? Mm-hmm. How do you feel?
Well, I find myself starting to close down, and I make an effort to keep open, and I'm just hoping you have some suggestion around that.
Yeah, I think it's important to really stay aware of what's going on for us, and maybe even not try to force it. You know, having a lot of compassion for that part of us is that this is hard. This is hard for me, rather than going straight to, oh, I have to stay open. You know, it's also okay to, like, okay, be who I am. Okay, at the moment, this is difficult. And I, you know, it really depends on the relationship, and it's hard to talk about a third person, but maybe you can actually bring that into the conversation, you know? Like, this sounds hard, or this makes me feel, there's probably something else, because if you feel like closing down, there's probably something underneath that. Do you know what is it that you're closing down from? Do you have a sense of that?
It's sort of a physical, it's a physical feeling of that energy. It feels poisonous or just noxious in some way.
Mm-hmm. So as a quality of like I'm being infected with something.
Right.
Or,
as if someone were to be coughing around you and you didn't want to get those germs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's going to kick in a lot of sort of self-protection tendency. Yeah. Yeah. So I think exploring that in yourself is a great place to start. And what brings that on and what's that about? You know, being very curious about that. And sometimes we have to be real with where we are, right? So sometimes we can be around people and we feel like, you know, what gives us the internal strength to kind of handle those situations, right? Practice or, you know, physically feeling well. What helps do not right in the situation, right? But looking at that in a more holistic way, right? Because if we try and do it when it becomes to the most difficult point where we're already like, I can't deal with this and I need to shut down. Oh, but I'm a Buddhist and I should try and be open, right? We're kind of setting ourselves up for failure. Like, that's not the place to do it. The place to do it is to be curious throughout your day, right? And throughout your week. Like, what strengthens me? What gives me, you know, like the ability to find these situations workable, find difficult situations workable, and you know, explore that place and putting these things in place outside of those situations, and then begin to work with the edge within the situation. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
So I've had a hard time kind of reconciling being one with what is and also being aware. So one can lose oneself in what is and become completely immersed in what is and lose awareness. So staying aware but also being one is kind of difficult.
Can you describe like an experience where you felt like you lost? Because it's really like sometimes we can have a theoretical question, but it's very difficult to approach it from that level, and if we can take it from an experiential example, then it can.
Well, I'm thinking about, you know, children. You know, mm-hmm. Children are not necessarily aware; they just are with whatever is, and so I remember saying to a teacher once, "Oh, you know, we're trying to get back to that childlike, mm-hmm. Just being." And she said, well, the difference between being a child and being an adult is the development of the awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just trying to understand a little bit better the difference.
And do you have an experience where you've really felt like at one, but you've lost your awareness?
Well, I think when I'm like immersed in, I guess it would be like concentration. I'm totally concentrated in something, and you know, hours go by, and then I kind of wake up, and it's I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of concentration versus awareness.
So concentration, I think, in this, obviously we use concentration in a Buddhist context as well, like for a meditation. So here, concentration in terms of like a particular task or something is not necessarily the same thing, because in terms of like being aware of a situation, like I think the concentration you're talking about is actually we're shutting down part of the experience, Right, because we're channeling our attention in one area, so that's not being really like aware of the, you're actually focusing. Which is that, and that's a practice sometimes as well, is, and it's a way of stabilizing the mind, is to focus on one thing. I think a way into this is more to do it from the experiential side of the body and sensations and emotions. And we can feel ourselves, what often happens is we contract away from certain experiences, things that we find difficult. So it's looking for those places in our experience where we're withdrawing. And this often happens in the body when a part of the body is injured or sick. We withdraw from that area. So we want to notice this and try, and sometimes we need to do that. Right, there's a reason that we do that, and it's because of the pain or something like that. But what often happens is then we get stuck in the contraction, and we don't then reintegrate all of our awareness. So we're looking for those kinds of places where we withdraw awareness. That might be an easier way into this, is to think about where do I withdraw and contract? And can I expand my awareness to include more? And actually, you know, when you're really aware of something, you become like you know something so well that it's not really like it's a separate object. Are you kind of, they have, you know, I think everyone has this experience, right? And we talk about communing with nature, right? Or seeing a sunset. When we have that experience, like there's an incredible sunset and your mind stops and you're not even in the present moment, you're in this like, someone talked about this writer who's got this book called The Eternal Now last night at dinner, right? You enter this space of the eternal now. It seems like primordial and yet completely present, and it feels like an expansion of awareness, a communion with the world, right? And that's what we're talking about. But there isn't a quality there of, oh, I'm missing something, or I'm having to kind of dumb down some area, right? It's open. Whereas the concentration you're talking about, I think, is actually not so open. Right? So the experiential quality, we can kind of feel, oh, am I ignoring something? Am I shutting, you know, am I contracting from somewhere? And can I open? Thank you very much.